WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
An HIV-positive man in Germany who also had leukemia underwent a bone marrow transplant to treat his cancer. After the transplant, the man appeared to be AIDS-free. His bone marrow donor had the rare gene mutation that offers resistance to the HIV virus, and now the leukemia patient is functionally cured of AIDS. But is this just a fluke? Does this signal a shift in the search for a cure? Joining us this morning to explain this case and what it means for the future of AIDS research is Nobel Prize-winning biologist Dr. David Baltimore. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello.
So explain how this happened.
Well, we have to go back a little bit. It was discovered some years ago that there are a small number of people who, no matter how often they're exposed to the AIDS virus, HIV, don't get AIDS, and the virus just doesn't take in their body. And so people started investigating why, and it turns out a small fraction of those people inherit two mutant genes. It's the same gene on the mother's and father's chromosome, which are genes that encode the receptor for the virus. So when a virus goes into a cell, it actually sees a protein on the surface of the cell and uses that as a hook to get into the cell. That hook is gone on all of the cells of these people because their genes don't encode that hook. So that provided the opportunity. When a man showed up who had leukemia and at the same time was HIV positive, to transplant him with bone marrow that was unable to support the growth of the virus.
So some people are born with a resistance, with cells that can't hook up to the AIDS virus. This patient had leukemia, but must a patient have leukemia? I mean, could this be something that would work for anybody?
It would work for anybody, but doing a bone marrow transplant is a dangerous and expensive operation, and the number of people who actually carry this mutation are very small. And to do a bone marrow transplant, you have to match the donor and the recipient very carefully genetically. So there are only a very small number of donors for any given recipient. And for all of those reasons, this is not likely to be a therapy that will be extended to the broader population.
So how many people are born with this mutation? About what percentage?
It depends on where you're born and what race you are. It turns out only Caucasians have the mutation, no Africans or Asians. And the sort of further north you are in Europe, the more likely you are to have the mutation. So it gets up to, and I forgot the numbers exactly, but close to 10% in Scandinavians. And it's fewer than that, but significant in Germans, and et cetera. Exactly why the mutation occurs and is at such high frequency, because this is a relatively high frequency, is a mystery.
So what I'm hearing you say, what it sounds to me like is, oh, well, this is interesting, but the circumstances were so rare that that's what it is, an interesting story. But it's not something that, you know, people can start going to their doctors and asking, could I get this treatment?
I think that's right. But it does have a much deeper implication, and that is that it works. That is, if you can find a way to get rid of this protein from the surface of sensitive cells, you can actually cure a patient. And so now we got to look for other ways to do this, which come to the same thing in the end, but are more acceptable, which cheaper, of broader applicability. And in fact, my own laboratory is working on such an idea. We even published the basic notion about, it must be 4 or 5 years ago now, and that is that you can put into cells let's call it a gene killer. It's a way of actually inactivating the gene for this receptor protein, this hook, using gene therapy methods.
Okay, so now that seems a little bit science fiction, by
yeah,
the way.
So that's...
Let me just mention that my guest is Nobel Prize-winning biologist Dr. David Baltimore. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. If you have a question for Dr. Baltimore, you can call 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So what it sounds like you're saying is, okay, so you could inject, say I have this immunity. So you could take my DNA and inject it in your cells, and suddenly your cells start not producing the hook for the HIV virus.
Not exactly. We don't have to go find the DNA in somebody who's resistant. We can mimic this situation with other kinds of molecular tricks that are very easy to come
by. So you could make the gene.
Actually, what we do is inactivate the gene. So we make we cause to be made inside the cell what's called an siRNA. It's a small RNA that seeks out this gene and inactivates it.
Okay, so I think maybe before I don't want to get too deep into the
exactly,
science here, but I'm not sure that people understand what that means, RNA. So.
Well, okay. The genetic material is DNA. Everybody who does a crossword puzzle knows that. And DNA is a long chain polymer that contains within it a code. And the code is the code, so-called code of life, the code that specifies all of the working parts of our body. It also specifies how they're put together, when they're made, all sorts of complicated things. So DNA is a fabulous molecule. It has a very close relative called RNA. And RNA is different chemically in a very small manner that's insignificant for this conversation. And so RNA also has this code in it. And there are RNA molecules that can bind to DNA molecules because the nice thing about this code is that it gives rise to two strands. You know, everybody, I think, knows DNA is two-stranded. And one strand has the code, and the other strand has the anti-code in it, just the opposite. And they can combine very nicely because it's all designed for molecular complementarity.
Okay, so that's the molecular biology lesson for the day.
That's your biology lesson for the day.
Let's take some calls. Yosef from Manhattan. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi, yes, Dr. Baltimore, a pleasure. I just was wondering if anybody was planning on taking stem cells from a patient and knocking out the, I believe it's CCR5 receptor, and then culturing them and grafting them back with their own patient-specific T cells or blood cells.
Yes, I am sure that people are trying to do that. And in principle, it should work. It's, again, a matter of expense, how hard it is, and safety, because that kind of technology has yet to be really demonstrated to be safe.
Now, you work in California, which is one of the only states where stem cell research is funded. How much would federal funding for stem cell research help your cause?
federal funding for stem cell research would be wonderful because it would spread the research across the country and enable people, no matter where they happen to live, to participate in this really exciting science. I think balkanizing the science in California or in Massachusetts or wherever is not a good thing for science in general. It's a great thing for our state here.
Do you think that that's one of the things that stimulated your research, is that you have been able to have access to this funding?
No. My research doesn't involve embryonic stem cells. It involves what are called adult stem cells. These are the stem cells that are determined to be stem cells only for a part of the body. And the ones I use are what are called blood stem cells. So you can work on those anywhere. They don't raise these kinds of ethical problems.
Let's take a call from John from Stony Brook. Hi, John. You're on with Dr. David Baltimore. John, are you there? Oh, I think we lost John. Let's try Ashley from Brooklyn. Hi, Ashley. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I had heard something about this genetic mutation that you had spoken of.
Yeah.
That it had something to do with the survivors of the plague. I'm not really sure.
Yes. Yeah, it's not a somatic mutation. It's an inherited mutation. But there has been suggestion that maybe the plague was the selective force that caused the gene to be beneficial. I don't exactly know how that would work myself, but I think it's hypothetical. But it's likely that something was some disease was selective in that way.
So there seems to be, a sense here that you can fix somebody's DNA and thereby create resistance to HIV. But could you fix somebody's DNA, and start playing around with their eye color and all kinds of other things?
No, you see, we're not really changing DNA by these techniques. We're changing cells in the case of the patient who got the cell transplant, or we're changing the expression of genes in the situation I described using small RNAs. But in neither case do we make a hereditary change in anybody, nor do we affect ordinary traits like eye color or whatever. That kind of gene therapy is still very much on the drawing boards. There is nobody attempting anything of that sort that I'm aware of.
Now, what about the issue about sort of developing this kind of therapy is costly and, you know, might not be available to, say, people in Africa who are becoming infected at a very rapid pace?
That's true. And certainly bone marrow transplant, the way it's done in the Western world, would not be available to many people in Africa. And therefore, again, in my own laboratory, I'm trying to develop techniques that would make this kind of therapy simpler. And if we could make it simple enough, then I think it would be within the conceivable cost that actually funders would be willing to pay to help deal with the African epidemic. That's a ways off yet.
When you say a ways off, I mean, is there a timeline for, say, you know, this being available to people? I mean, I know what happens is people read articles in the paper and then they think, oh, look, a cure is imminent. But people who are carrying the HIV virus, I mean, when could this kind of gene therapy become available?
Well, I hate to prognosticate on things like that because all sorts of surprises occur. But I would just advise anybody who is HIV positive to continue taking their medicines and not depend on new things coming along. I would hope that within a decade we could see this kind of thing be available to people. But it requires commercial development, which it doesn't have yet. It requires clinical investigation. And then it finally would require FDA approval. So those are all long-term things.
Let's take another call. Edward from the Bronx. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Dr. Baltimore. My question has to do with the fact that What about situations where the infection is already in the patient's cell?
Yes.
What do you do about that as opposed to getting a new infection?
Well, actually, what we're talking about is a therapy for people who are already infected. Because the virus actually only stays in any one given cell for a short period of time, a few days. The virus infects the cell makes a lot of new virus. That virus then breaks out of the cell and goes on and infects other cells. So there's a continual stream of infected cells infecting new cells, infecting new cells, infecting new cells, that goes on over the whole time of a person's infection. It's really why the virus is so debilitating unless it's stopped chemically. Now, with the chemicals we have today, we can at least slow up that process of virus transmission in the body so that it doesn't occur so fast and doesn't occur so broadly, and that's why we can stop the progression of the disease. But we could do the same thing with these kinds of genetic therapies, because what we would do is to put the therapy into uninfected cells in the body so they can't become infected, and those cells can then provide the normal cellular functions that make our immune system work.
Thanks for your call, Ed. Now, we have just about 30 seconds, but what are some of the other promising areas for looking for treatment for HIV at this point or even a cure?
Yeah, there are new drugs coming along, drugs that prevent the binding of the virus to its hook, the drugs that stop the virus growth in new ways that we haven't seen before. So it's a very active field of investigation. And then we keep hoping that there'll be some immunologic way of stopping the virus and ultimately providing a vaccine. That has been a frustration for the scientific community because we just haven't been able to find a way to make a vaccine.
Right.
But there's still lots of people trying.
Thanks very much, and we need to end it there. Dr. David Baltimore is a Nobel Prize-winning biologist from Caltech. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Pleasure to be with
you. HIV. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. When we come back, we'll talk about the 70s and much more. All of that coming up after the news.